A criminal trial in Miami exposes the deep underbelly of Florida politics, and a former state senator is convicted of election crimes. I'm Danny Rivero. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. Tim Padgett is out this week. The so-called ghost candidate scandal of 2020 rocked South Florida politics, with a fake candidate siphoning votes away from a Democrat and helping the Republican win. That trial wrapped up this week, and we have all the details. And it's election season. All the nuts and bolts things you need to know to cast a ballot on the November 5th elections. From ballot drop boxes to early voting dates, we got you covered. Also on the roundup, artists in Miami are hoping to better advocate for themselves by harnessing the power of information. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Danny Rivero. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. The center of gravity for Florida politics over the last few weeks has been a courtroom in Miami, where ex-Florida Republican Senator Frank Artiles was on trial facing charges that he helped rig a 2020 election. Frank Artiles was found guilty of excessive campaign contributions, conspiracy to commit excessive contributions, and falsely swearing an oath. All three of those charges are felonies that could carry five-year sentences. The jury did clear him of a fourth charge for the charge of aiding a false registration. The jury found that Artiles cooked up a scheme to help a Republican win a competitive Florida Senate race by paying a man with the same last name as the Democrat in the race to confuse voters and siphon votes away from the Democrat and help the Republican get elected. And the thing is, this scheme actually worked. The so-called ghost candidate in the race did not actually campaign, but he got over 6,000 votes. And the Republican in the race, State Senator Ileana Garcia, won by only 32 votes. What are your thoughts on this scandal? Were you paying attention to it? Have you seen the results that came out this week? You can call us at 800-743-WLRN to give us some thoughts. That's 800-743-9576. This ghost candidate scandal and the trial showed tentacles of a dirty underbelly of Florida politics, with much of its epicenter here in South Florida. And to break it all down for us, we're joined by Chuck Rabin, a crime reporter for the Miami Herald. And we're also joined by Mario Arisa, an investigative reporter with a nonprofit news outlet, Floodlight. Chuck, Mario, thanks for coming on.
Hi, Danny.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be here.
Chuck, let's start with you. Take us back to the long ago 2020 election. There was a lot of noise and untrue conspiracy theories about Democrats stealing a presidential election. But there was an actual fraud taking place in this Florida Senate District 37 race. How did that fraud play out as the election was underway?
Well, it's a little complicated, but it goes back to a fellow named Patrick Bainter, who is a Republican political operative who was told by members of a Senate committee that there was a vulnerable race down in South Florida. And it came out in trial that he contacted some people he knew in Palm Beach because he was trying to get some boots on the ground to get whatever information he could from what was going on down there. And they suggested he speak to Frank Artiles. And Artiles got in touch with Bainter, who agreed to pay him a certain amount of money, and came up with a plan to hire a fella named Alexis Rodriguez, who shared a name with the incumbent, as the ghost candidate in the case.
The incumbent was, at the time, Democratic State Senator Jose Javier Rodriguez. So you had two Rodriguezes running against a Garcia in this race.
Yeah, it was convenient. So he was actually told that he didn't have to campaign. He'd be coached. We'll help you qualify. And at trial, it was suggested that they'd pay him $50,000 for his name, basically. And it worked. He won about 6,300 votes or so, and Ileana Garcia, the Republican candidate, won by about 32 votes at the end.
So basically, the hope was to confuse voters by having multiple candidates with the same last name, siphon votes away from the Democrat, and it worked.
That's it. It was that simple.
And at some point, we're literally talking about bundles of cash being given to the sham candidate in this race, right?
There was cash involved. There were a couple of $5,000 payments and a $3,000 payment, and then a $9,000 payment. A lot of the other stuff was, for instance, Artiles paid Alexis Rodriguez, the ghost candidate's daughter's tuition. He allegedly gave about $11,000 for a truck for Artiles' daughter that he was going to buy her for Christmas. The part at trial that was a little confusing was that Rodriguez admitted that even the cash payments, Artiles had written down that they were for, you know, purchases that he was going to make, and that, you know, the former senator had requested like profits from them. But the state believed that was all kind of a, you know, to in case something like this happened in the end, to cover up for that.
Right.
For that.
And the ghost candidate, as we're calling him in this, Alexis Rodriguez, he has admitted that this was essentially a fraud. He pled guilty to two election fraud counts in 2021, and he testified at trial, right? Was he found to be credible by the jurors?
I don't know how credible he was. He was given a withhold of adjudication, which means he wasn't found to be convicted for the crimes. He had the same charges as Artiles, basically. And in exchange, he agreed to testify. He said it was a sham. That was his statement. And he said he felt ashamed. As far as credibility, I mean, I think the jury found him a little shady. He was broke. He needed money. He admitted to that. But I guess the state proved their case to the jurors.
Mario, I want to bring you into this conversation. You sat through most, if not the entire trial, right?
Correct, yeah.
And what you know, as a takeaway, what was the thing that stood out most to you during this trial?
I was really struck by the care and attention that the jury showed in trying to parse just how much money Artiles gave to Rodriguez, and to try and figure out just how much of that money was a campaign donation and how much of it was just, you know, kind of like what Artiles' camp would call legitimate business dealings, what Rodriguez would call maybe a scam. And they really came to a Solomonic sort of like cut the baby in half determination, right? There's about 44,000 that was in question here, and they basically said 22,000 of this was illegal campaign contributions in excess of the limits.
And was this the only race, because I want to back up for a second, is this kind of thing uncommon for quote unquote ghost candidates to run in any race, or is this just a rare case where it seems like that actually did determine the outcome of an election? Mario.
Ghost candidates are legal in the state of Florida. Funding them can be tricky. You can run afoul of laws. There have been about 80 ghost candidates total, or third party candidates total. But in this particular election in 2020, there were three ghost candidates in three Senate races that were all sort of promoted by the same pool of money, and were all promoted by same group of mailers that came out late in October of that year.
I want to go to the phones. We have David calling from Miami. David, thanks for calling the South Florida Roundup. You're on.
Total third-party candidates total. But in this particular election, 2020, there were
We're hearing some echo. David, are you there? All right. Sorry about that. We'll continue. Chuck, I want to go back to you. I mean, a lot of this money came from, at first, Patrick Bainter, who was a top consultant for Florida's Senate Republicans. He played a major role in giving this money to Artiles, who then gave the money to the ghost candidate. I hope people can follow. I mean, Patrick Bainter is not someone who's necessarily in the limelight, but he does play a major role in state politics. Is that right?
He does. He is he calls himself a peanut farmer from Gainesville. He may farm peanuts. I don't know. He has about 200 acres, but in reality, he owns a company called Data Targeting that is a marketing and research arm of Republican politics. So he's the shadowy background political operative that you rarely see, who has had a contract with the senatorial committee for decades and basically does what's requested of him.
And Mario, I want to go to you. There's a lot of deep drama here. And as you reported, a lot of the backstory here comes down to who the Democrat in this race was. Then State Senator Jose Javier Rodriguez, he was a major proponent of clean energy. and pushing the state of Florida to address climate change, and that made him some really big enemies at large utilities like Florida Power and Light. How did that backstory factor into this overall scheme from what we know?
Yeah, so JJR had a proposal to sort of democratize the production of solar energy in the state of Florida a little bit that we know was received with a lot of negative emotions at Florida Power and Light. And though we can't definitively say that the money that came to promote the ghost candidates was from Florida Power and Light, we can say that the organization had the means, motive, and is connected via business relationships to the conspiracy to steal the District 37 seat at almost every level.
And Eric Szilagyi, the former CEO of FPL, resigned just shortly after you reported somewhat his connection to this scandal. He, you know, you uncovered an email from Szilagyi around this time saying he wanted to make the Democrat in this life, in this race's life, quote, a living hell.
Right. Yeah. He said that, or he admitted to that in the summer of 2022. We put that reporting out in October. He left his position very unexpectedly in January. And the CEO of NextEra, the chairman of the board, did say in the parting remarks that the press coverage had something to do with his early retirement.
And Mario, I mean, you've been following this story and this tale for quite a long time. The backstory here was also Senate Republicans had a majority in the state of Florida. They wanted to expand their majority. And, you know, one of their key tools in this box was Patrick Bainter, this top consultant. Was there any indication that high up politicians, elected officials had any inclination into what was going on here?
None that I can report at this time, but I do have a lot of questions about who knew what and when, right? Like it's my understanding that the way that, and this was expressed at trial, you know, the Senate Republican leadership does tend to take a very active role in determining what money gets spent in those races. A lot of those folks went on record at the time saying they didn't have anything to do with it. And I think those denials should be reviewed at this point, right? We should be asking, well, wait a second, what did the Republican leadership know at the time and when did they know it?
I'm Danny Rivero. You're listening to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. We're talking about a criminal trial on an election fraud case that ended this week with the former Republican state senator being found guilty of three felonies. We're joined by Chuck Rabin of the Miami Herald and Mario Arisa of Floodlight. You can call us at 800-743-WLRN. Again, that's 800-743-9576. And, you know, we should mention here, Frank Artiles' attorney said he respects the jury, but they do hope to appeal this. Is that right, Chuck?
They do. They believe one of the things when Mario mentioned how attentive the jury is, he was right. One of the amazing things that they did was they attached to the verdict a sheet listing the actual six counts where they think Artiles gave money that went overboard, that was excessive. And the attorney looked at that, and during the trial, those were the monies that I spoke about earlier that Artiles claimed were for business deals to, you know, where he was supposed to get parts of the profit. So he suggested that that was going to be his argument on appeal.
I want to go back to the phones. David, we tried you earlier. We'll try you again. David in Miami, you're on.
Thank you. I'm sorry I missed you earlier. I'm so happy that you're covering this situation. I knew Jose Javier Rodriguez pretty well. He's in my district, and I was so sad that this happened. And I was just wondering, you know, it's good these two guys have to take the fall for this, but that question of who knew what when, I think, is so important because, you know, it disenfranchises so many people. And I'm wondering if there's any other repercussions that might come down the line for this type of thing. So surprising that 70 ghost candidates have been run in the state of Florida. I didn't know that. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you, David. Mario, I want to go to you. The Republican State Senator Ileana Garcia, who won this 2020 race thanks to this scheme, but she was reelected in 2022. She's maintained that she knew nothing at all about any of this shady stuff going on. Her campaign director did testify in this trial, right? What did they say?
Yeah, it was really interesting to see him testifying there. He basically said that there were two people in control of the purse strings of the Eliana Garcia campaign at the time, Republican leadership and Pat Boehner.
This consultant that gave the money.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, continue.
Yeah, no, it raises a lot of questions about coordination between Eliana Garcia's campaign staff and the sort of other figures here. I mean, she's vehemently denied having anything to do with this for a while, but it was really interesting to see her campaign manager on the stand saying that he'd had conversations with Artiles as well, and that Artiles had been giving him advice about, you know, how to advertise his candidate. And it was also really interesting to see how cash-strapped and sort of an underdog Eliana Garcia's campaign was, right? Like, this is a campaign that, but for the intervention of these forces and this ghost candidate, would likely not have won this race.
Right, and, you know, she was reelected in 2022, but at the time she was an upstart. She was known as the founder of Latinos for Trump, and she was just trying to get her door into politics. This really helped her get her door in, her foot in the door.
Absolutely.
Chuck, you were going to add something?
You know, it's also, it was a little strange to see that Artiles actually was helping Eliana Garcia's campaign manager, like he just volunteered work. But to be fair, it's entirely possible that they really didn't, you know, her camp wasn't aware of what was going on. I mean, this may have been above her head. Nothing came out specifically. The manager was asked that during trial, and he was adamant that they had no clue what was going on as far as I was concerned.
And Chuck, when it comes to the sentencing, Frank Artiles was, you know, found guilty of these three felonies. When is sentencing expected in this case?
They're getting together again the 21st for some technical issue, and they're going to announce when they will have sentencing after that. So it'll be sometime after the 21st of this month.
And how much time, at least on the face of it, I mean, we know how that goes. It often comes down, but how much time is Artiles potentially facing if he's hit with everything?
If I mean, it's pure guess, right? I mean, it, you know, if they'll probably run the three convictions concurrently, so that's down to 5 years, and who knows? You know, he may not spend time behind bars. I don't know.
And Mario, you had an interaction with Frank Artiles right as the trial was wrapping up. What did Frank Artiles tell you at that time?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those sort of like restroom conversations, but I am a reporter and it was on the record, right? But he was in the restroom next to me and he was like, man, this is a total waste of time.
In the restroom.
In the restroom.
Sorry, I had to get that in there. Chuck Rabin is a crime reporter for the Miami Herald, and Mario Ariza is an investigative reporter for the nonprofit news outlet Floodlight. Chuck, Mario, many thanks for coming on. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Danny.
Pleasure.
Still to come on the South Florida Roundup, it's election season and everything you need to know about deadlines and procedures coming up next. It's election season, South Florida, and that means there's a lot of chatter about the nuts and bolts of voting. Like, what are the deadlines? Where can you drop off a ballot? When does early voting start? How can you find your polling location and be sure that that's your polling location? There's few people better equipped to answer these questions than Joyce Griffin. For 40 years, Joyce has worked in the Supervisor of Elections office in Monroe County, taking care of all election needs for the Florida Keys. And she's been elected as a Supervisor of Elections ever since 2012. And she's actually retiring this year. Joyce joins me now from Key West. Joyce, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
And I want to put it out to the callers. If you have any questions on all these voting matters, for you want to comment or you have a question for Joyce, please call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. So Joyce, I'll ask you a little bit about your retirement later. But first, I want to talk to you about some of this nuts and bolts stuff when it comes to this election cycle. First up, what's the last day someone can register to vote if they haven't done so?
Monday, October the 7th.
Monday, October the 7th. So in 3 days from now.
Yes.
Okay. We're gonna just run through these things because these are important, okay. important data points. Vote by mail ballots for people that have already asked for them have already been sent out. Are you actually starting to receive any of those back?
Yes. Yes, we are. I think we have about maybe a
We're losing your audio a tiny bit. I think you said that.
Sorry, we've got about 1,200 of them back. I sent out about 14,000.
Got it. So okay, we hear you loud and clear now.
Thank you.
So you know, for someone who would like to request a vote by mail ballot but hasn't done so, what's the latest that someone can or should request a vote by mail ballot?
Well, the last day is the 24th. We are suggesting you do it right away because we have to mail it to you. You have to vote it and you have to mail it back. Or if you're in town, you could drop it off at our secure ballot intake stations that's located at any of our early voting sites. I have an early voting site about mile marker 5. One about mile marker 30, 150, 180, and then there's the last one up around 105. You know, I'm 130 miles long of two-lane highway. We recently moved our Key West office that was sitting on mile marker 0 at the south end of the island. We're up here at the Stock Island, the island above Key West. And to those that live in the north end of the island, I'm about a half a mile away. So I think our offices are pretty centrally located. And at each one of those spots, for early voting, we have a drop box. Right now, we only have the secure ballot intake station our three offices.
We'll get to the early voting in a second. But just to repeat, the latest someone can legally request a vote by mail ballot is October 24th.
Yes.
But get it in as soon as you possibly can, according to Joyce.
As soon as you can, yes.
And you just mentioned some things about these ballot drop boxes. There has been some changes to ballot drop boxes in recent years. These places where someone can drop off a vote by mail ballot instead of mailing it in. What should people be aware of when it comes to those changes and where things are right now?
Well, for us, our one office moved from mile marker 0 to mile marker 5. And I will tell you, we've had, I'm going to say maybe 10 ballots come back not signed. And there's a big red X on the back. Make sure you sign your ballot. And I don't want the voters to be afraid of not voting by mail because they're worried about their signature. Here in Monroe County, we check every ballot as we receive it. That day, if the signature doesn't look like it matches, we send you a letter. If we have your email address, we will email you. And if we have your phone, we'll call you.
I want to zero in on this ballot signature thing. There is a signature field on the envelope itself. Is that right?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
So when you're sealing up the envelope to send it out, people need to remember to turn it over and sign it on the back.
Yes, sir. Well, when you're sealing it, the signature line goes over the flap of the ballot. So it's right there looking at you in the face. Just seal it and then sign it and send it in.
Sounds good. And, you know, I want to turn now to early voting. It's when a lot of people cast ballots. When does early voting start and how long does it run for?
Well, in Monroe County, because you have to do it 1 week mandatory by the state. You have the option of going 2 weeks, and we go that 2 weeks. We will start on October the 21st. We go straight through every single day, and we end on November the 2nd. That includes two Saturdays and a Sunday that we will be open for early voting.
And I, just for the audience, I did look it up. In Miami-Dade County, Broward County, and Palm Beach County, it's all the same calendar for early voting. So between October 21st and the Sunday right before the election, early voting for all of South Florida, essentially.
Well, we end on the Saturday.
So in the Keys, you end on the Saturday, but
yes, nobody comes to the polls on Sunday.
Got it.
Nobody.
Copy that. I will, for the audience's sake, say in Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach, that last Sunday it is open. So it's open through November 3rd. So just depending on your county, everyone should be aware of that.
Yes.
Awesome. Thank you for bearing with us while we tackle this. This is kind of the broccoli of politics.
Thank you for helping me get the information out to our voters.
Of course. And, you know, a lot of people still would like to vote in person on election day. Yep. If someone wants to do that and that's how they choose to vote, how can someone check and double check their precinct location to make sure they're showing up to the right place to cast their ballot?
Well, there's a few reasons. One, all supervisors have to have that information on their website. So you can go to the website and look for my voter status. We have just put in the mail. They should be hitting the mailboxes this week. We sent everybody a sample ballot who didn't request a vote by mail ballot. And we have that on the sample ballot also. So, or you could just call, we'll tell you. But polling places haven't changed since August. So if you voted in August, just go back to that same location in Monroe County.
Got it. And, again, to be clear for everyone, it would be good practice to check online what your polling location is, especially if you didn't vote in the primary election. Kind of my last question on some of this nuts and bolts stuff. If someone received a vote by mail ballot and they didn't mail it in, they didn't take it to a Dropbox location, election day comes around, they still have their vote by mail ballot in their hand, can they still vote?
They will have to drop it off at the office. And we in Monroe County, at our three office we'll have our secure ballot intake stations, otherwise known as drop boxes. We have them set up. The problem with, you cannot take a voted ballot to the polls that you want to have counted, because Florida law says that a ballot must be in the supervisor of elections office by 7 p.m. And those poll workers will not be back in the office before 7. So they are taught not to accept those ballots that want to be counted. Now, if you want to bring it in with you and say, okay, I got this, but I don't want to vote it, I want to vote here, you can do it that way. But our poll books, per se, are electronic, and they will update you that you have voted right away. So if you had voted a vote by mail ballot and you go into the polls, they will let you know you've already voted. Or if you didn't vote your vote by mail ballot and you vote at the polls, if you had put one in the mail, it will be stopped when we check it in.
Got it.
So that's how we prevent double voting.
Copy that. I'm Danny Rivero. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. We're talking with Monroe County Supervisor of Elections Joyce Griffin about the nuts and bolts of voting for the general election on November 5th, just a few weeks away. You can call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. Now, Joyce, moving on, you've been working in elections in Monroe County for about 40 years. Is that right? Is it 40?
40.
Wow. And
almost 41.
And you've been the elected supervisor of elections since 2012. I imagine that you've seen quite a lot of changes to how we actually vote in that time. Is that right? Yes.
Oh, yes.
Tell us about it, please.
Well, when I started working here, we were on the lever machines. And then for Monroe County, we went to the punch cards for, I'm going to say, 3 years. And then we left them behind and we went on to the electronic, where you fill in the ovals and you vote your ballot. So we've been on paper since 1993, I think it was.
And what's it been like to follow these elections through all the years, to be working them from the, you know, the very much contested 2000 election here in in Florida, all the changes that came after that, to all these laws that are being passed and stop the steel conspiracies and whatnot. From your perspective, I mean, how's it been like to be, you know, actually working in elections during this whole time period?
I understand, and I'm actually kind of flattered when people get so interested in their vote. Your vote has come to you by way of a lot of sacrifices in people's lives. You know, our military has fought for our country, and some have lost their lives, or they have come back maimed, and I work hard. I keep them in my mind. I'm trying to do best so that they can be proud. And when people get upset and they go, oh, you don't want my vote to count, I really believe a lot of that is because they are hearing news. You know, I'm old, and when I was little, we only had 3 TV stations, and the news was the news. But now everybody knows if you want to hear this side, you got to go to this channel, and that side, you got to go to that channel. And there's not a lot of people walking down the middle of the aisle. There is nothing wrong with elections in Florida. Nothing. President Trump said that he wished all states did elections like Florida. Governor DeSantis pounded his chest and said, we got it right. And yet the legislature feels they need to change things. Why? Because Georgia messed up.
And
there is nothing wrong with Florida.
And Joyce, I do want to ask you about this. As I mentioned, this is the last election you'll be working in this capacity, at least. And in 2022, you told WLRN that you would not run for your job again. And let's listen to a quick clip of you explaining why.
They're passing some laws that I'm worried that at some point they will be an ethics problem for me to follow them.
So Joyce, you were just talking a little bit about it. The 2020 election did run extremely smoothly here, and laws continue to change, and that rubbed you the wrong way. Do you still feel the same way, that this is a part of why you're retiring?
Yes. I don't like a lot of the laws that they're changing. People may not see as, you know, not a big deal. For instance, you used to could request a vote by mail ballot for 2 general elections. Now you could only request for 1. Well, when elections office are mailing out reminders and stuff, like I always send out a vote by mail request form to the people in my county who had not requested, to remind them, you know, if when their absentee expired, we send that out. And it wasn't all that many. Well, now I've got to send to the whole county. What county has extra money for this? That might sound a little silly, but it's not. It goes along with all of the other things that they are changing. For example, to request a vote by mail ballot, you must file the DSDE 160.
I don't know what that is.
It's a new form. Well, a lot of our ladies, we still have stationery. If somebody sits down with their stationery and they put every single piece of information I need on that paper, I can't accept it because it's not on a DSDE 160. Why? So your littler counties like me, we get that and we call them and we say, we can't take this, but let me take your request over the phone. My big sister up there in Dade County, she's got over 1 million voters. Can they do that? I don't think so. So I think that this is one of those things that the legislature, who has never set foot in my office, they're up there doing knee-jerk reactions to Georgia. Shame on you. You come from a good state who does good elections, and just hold on to that. If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Obviously, I mean, you're very passionate about this.
I am.
Do you feel, you know, despite all this, well-prepared for the November 5th election and confident that everything's in line that you need to be in line?
Oh, yeah. We got this. We've had, you know, elections. They will roll out. It's just that my job is to count legal ballots. That's my job. And I don't understand. This is a Republican state. I live in a Republican county, and the Republican legislature's making it harder for people to vote. That doesn't make sense to me. I need them to go and talk to their supervisors, talk to our association, find out what really needs to be changed and what is a knee-jerk reaction. The supervisors of elections of Florida are a group of wonderful people, and we work hard, and we get insulted, and I get that, because people are frightened, and people shouldn't be frightened. Shame on the news that's frightening the people. Shame on them for saying your vote doesn't want to get counted. Back in 2020, I sent out 22,000, we counted 22,000 vote by mail ballots. I had like 50 that didn't get counted because the signature didn't match, or they didn't sign the envelope at all. Believe it, people don't sign the envelope at all. And
as
even after reaching
us.
Out to them, they didn't do that. When you get you count 22,000 and you got less than 50 that didn't get counted, that's not bad. And people are afraid to vote by mail because they say, oh, it won't get counted because of my signature. That's a shame. My daughter was a teacher. She went to work before 7 and didn't come home until after 7. Your policemen never know when they're going to be free. Doctors never know. You know, people should be able to vote by mail, so especially this ballot. It's my ballot, 17 inches long, front and back. There's a lot of questions on there that people need to understand.
And take their time at home.
Yes.
And
yes.
Joyce, you know, question, practical question about poll workers. Have you had any difficulty finding poll workers in Monroe County?
No. It's about status quo. It's status quo. It's I think we're pretty good. We still are sending out applications, but mostly in case, you know, our poll workers are wonderful, dedicated. They are the soldiers of democracy.
Thank you.
But they get sick too.
Joyce, we do got our wrap. I apologize. Okay. Joyce Griffin is the Monroe County Supervisor of Elections. This will be her final election before retiring. And a reminder that if you've missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you so much, Joyce. Still to come on the South Florida Roundup, artists in Miami feel left behind, and now there's a plan to fight back with big data. The arts and culture industry brings an economic impact of more than $2 billion per year, according to a study commissioned by the county government, by the Miami-Dade County government. And at the base of this thriving economy is an estimated 2,500 independent artists, the people who create the work that ends up on the gallery walls, the artists who program events at museums and galleries, the mural artists that paint building facades that make some areas hip and ready for Instagram posts. But most information about the arts and cultural world is based on the top-level economic impact of the arts, on things like the amount of beds that get filled at hotels, on ticket sales for fairs, and jobs created. Many artists across Miami-Dade feel left out of this conversation, and this week they've launched a project aiming to fight back with data. The Miami Artist Census is an attempt to collect data and information about the artists themselves that make up this thriving community. I recently spoke with artists Kerry C. and Misael Soto about this new data gathering project and what they hope to achieve. Misael, maybe let's start with you. You've called yourself the chief instigator of the Miami Artist Census. Why is this something that you see as necessary for the Miami arts community?
I know very few artists who aren't struggling to make rent. I know very few artists who don't complain about feeling as if the institutions in our city don't serve us, don't listen to us, don't care about us, even though they oftentimes claim to on their websites or in their talks. And when you start to look around, you realize all of the information that's out there has been, well, it's already very limited, it's very siloed, and it is typically produced for the needs ultimately of an institution, a government agency. And so we were like, okay, well, then we need to do our own. Like, it needs to be, if it's going to be for us, it's going to serve us, it needs to be by us. The census kind of has two goals. One is to affect policymaking and funders' viewpoints on like what we need and how they might be able to help us. And the other one is self-advocacy. And it's like, our sample size needs to be as big as possible because we want this data to help as many as possible to advocate for themselves.
You're going to be working a lot on actually analyzing what you get back from this artist's census. What kind of data points are you hoping to gather? Is it income? Is it access to health insurance and things like that? Like, what is it you're hoping to find out?
We are asking questions about things like income and health insurance and other basic demographic questions. There are almost 90 questions on the survey. We're really wanting to ask questions about as many things as we think are likely to affect the experience of artists here. Not only do we have a question asking respondents if they've considered leaving Miami, but we also ask them, what have been the biggest challenges to you personally in being an artist in Miami? And I think that that will also be very interesting and useful information for decision makers to have. It may not occur to them that artists are often not doing well economically.
It can be a little tricky to pin down what art is specifically. It could be a whole variety of things that people do. Are you letting people self-define whether or not they're an artist when they're filling in this survey?
Yes, exactly. Being an artist and like what art is oftentimes so nebulous already that it's just kind of the nature of the beast. So if you self-identify as an artist, then you are an artist.
How are you going to go about making sure that this gets before the people that it needs to get before and that, you know, you are getting responses to it that give you good data on the other side of it?
We're going to be doing outreach through as many of these institutions that we also want to have the data. So getting into as many kind of spaces, you could think of it as canvassing the county.
We also did a lot of work collaboratively on just designing the survey so that it, once people are in there, it will feel maximally inclusive and inviting and I don't know if friendly is the right word, but I think that most of us have had the experience of filling out other people's surveys geared towards artists where we read the questions and then think, this doesn't really feel like it was written for me, or but what about my experience? It doesn't fit into any of these answers. And it was one of the main things that we worked on, actually, was trying to really figure out how we could be more inclusive.
We're having this conversation in the context of Governor Ron DeSantis just vetoing all arts grants in the state, amounting to $32 million in cuts to arts programs statewide. And also, as Miami-Dade County just cut almost $1 million in arts grants on top of those state cuts in the latest budget they just passed. Is part of the goal with gathering this data to show policymakers what's at stake, not just for art institutions, but actual artists when funding like that gets slashed?
Definitely. Definitely. And I will say from firsthand experience, I'm in a show coming up. I'll leave out the details. But talks initially were that they didn't know if they were going to be able to pay artists in the exhibition because of the state funding being cut. So it's already being a topic of conversation, and it is instinctively, institutionally pushed down to the artists immediately. And that to me is a symptom of something that has existed for decades in Florida and in Miami. And that is why we're doing it. We're not doing it in kind of like people are feeling like, oh, this is a knee-jerk reaction to like what happens with DeSantis. But no, this DeSantis is a system, is a symptom of something greater. This census is coming out at a time, it just so happens to happen at the same time, but it's been a long time coming. And yeah, it's really, really tough work. But being an artist is always way tougher than people will ever tell you it is. So it's kind of par for the course. Any kind of like collectivization, or I'm going to use the U word, unionization of artists needs to be forward thinking. I believe And to do that, we just have to really kind of take our time and understand who we are and how we can be as inclusive as possible moving forward. Because I truly believe that's the only way things are going to get any better.
That was artist Misael Soto and Carrie C., who are helping spearhead the Miami Artist Census. In organizing the project, both artists drew inspiration from the Los Angeles Artist Census, a project launched in 2019 by a fellow local.
My name is Tatiana Vahan. I am a visual artist based in Los Angeles, and I'm originally from Miami, Florida.
Vahan read an article in the Los Angeles Times about how cultural institutions raised hundreds of millions of dollars for upgrades of existing buildings, and it rubbed her the wrong way. All the artists she knew were struggling to pay rent, and here was all this money going to building upgrades.
I actually wanted to write an opinion piece to the LA Times to respond to this article from an artist's perspective, and I was looking for quantitative data to help paint the picture of what artists experience in LA, and I couldn't find any. I couldn't find much data. I definitely couldn't find the data I wanted to find about artists in the United States in general. Data these days is a building block for infrastructure. It informs funding, it informs policy. And without having data, you're sort of, you know, for funders, it's like throwing money into a dark room. And so that's how the LA Artist Census came around. It was to fill a void or a gap in this information.
2 years ago, the results of the Los Angeles Artist Census were released. Now she had the data she was looking for, concrete numbers she could cite.
So it revealed what we had suspected going into the research, which is, you know, how precarious many artists' lives are in Los Angeles. 95% of respondents to our survey were making under $5,000 from their art practices. We found that half of the people who were employed had no employment benefits. I'm going to read this off. 61% had no paid sick days. 3/4 had no paid time off. So these are like basic, you know, benefits. And then also we had a question about basic necessities. Have you gone without a basic necessity in the last 2 years? And the most common basic necessities artists went without were healthcare and food, healthcare being number one. And all of this data together is sort of painting a picture. To me, I feel like this created a ground from which to organize.
She dreams that one day, every part of the country will have their own version of the artist census to paint a better, more comprehensive picture of the art world. Next up is her hometown of Miami. The Miami Artist Census Group says that it's already received over 100 surveys since it opened on Tuesday. It hopes to get over 1,000 people to fill out the form to make the results as robust as possible. You can visit miamiartistcensus.com to participate. Finally on the roundup, for 3 days this week, the International Longshoremen Association went on strike for the first time since 1977 to push for higher wages in a new contract. But on Thursday night, the two sides reached a tentative agreement to raise wages by 62% over 6 years, and they agreed to extend their expired contract until January 15th. 36 ports across the eastern seaboard in Texas were affected, and among those were Port Miami and Port Everglades in Broward County. WLRN's Carlton Gillespie went to a picket line in Fort Lauderdale.
These are the sounds of the international longshoremen strike happening near the entrance to Port Everglades. Local ILA President Johnny Dixon says the group is demanding stronger wages and benefits and job protections from automation.
But when it comes down to replacing a man or a woman's job, we're totally opposed to that.
Dixon says the port community has been supportive of the strike, and you can hear it when trucks leaving the port roll by. Supportive honks from trucks that might have been loaded up by these striking workers. And Dixon says they're in it for the long haul.
However long it takes to get a contract, they're willing to be here. They don't care if it's 3 days, 3 weeks, 3 months, 6 months. Our membership is not backing down. They know their worth.
Negotiations are still ongoing. I'm Carlton Gillespie in Fort Lauderdale.
Those negotiations did come to a pause last night. The strike has been broken. Ports are open. And that will do it for the South Florida Roundup this week. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. It's produced by Jimena Romero with help from Polly Landis. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mares. Richard Ives answers the phones. MJ Smith on the boards today, too. I'm Danny Rivero. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening.